It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. When the Affordable Care Act expanded Medicaid for low-income Americans, 10 million more people gained access to health insurance as a result. But in the Republicans' long-running quest to repeal and replace, or maybe just repeal, Obamacare, rolling back the Medicaid expansion is a central component. It's a favorite target of conservatives who think it's wasteful and encourages able-bodied people not to work. Obamacare expanded to more working-age single adults with no dependents, for example. But the real story is, as you'd expect, a bit more complicated. Who is on Medicaid? What do they stand to lose if it's rolled back? Joining me now to explain are WNYC health reporter Mary Harris and Mary Beth Musumeci, Associate Director of the Kaiser Family Foundation's Program on Medicaid and the Uninsured. Hi, Mary, and Mary Beth, welcome to WNYC.
Hey, Brian.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
So, Mary, you have an interactive feature on WNYC.org that people can use to learn. To find out more about Medicaid, what's the project?
Yeah, so our project was really to reveal all the ways that Medicaid touches your life that you might not know about. So we wanted to really break down for people in New York and New Jersey, who might you know who's using Medicaid if you don't use it yourself? And what we found is that it really reaches deep into our communities. It's become kind of a fabric of our lives, and we may not see it. So 20% of adults under age 65 in New York get Medicaid right now. That's 14% in New Jersey. Half of all births in New York are covered by Medicaid. It's really just everywhere. I even called the director of the budget at Newark Public Schools, and she gets $2 million a year from Medicaid because it helps her pay for school buses for people who are special ed students. It helps her pay for all sorts of things you're just not thinking are tied into Medicaid.
Mary Beth, is this like people who thought they supported the Affordable Care Act but don't like Obamacare? They didn't realize it was the same thing. Are a lot of people, especially children, on programs that they may think are state programs or something else, but that are actually Medicaid?
So I think it's very common for people to not realize that Medicaid is a critical safety net until you're in that situation. So until you're a senior or a caregiver of a senior looking at how to finance the cost of nursing home care, or until you perhaps have a baby who's born prematurely and has a stay in the neonatal intensive care unit and has significant disabilities, these are examples of where the program comes in and provides a really critical safety net, helping make coverage affordable and available. And it's, you know, oftentimes people don't envision themselves being in that situation.
Mary, do you want to expand on that? Things that are Medicaid that people don't realize are Medicaid?
Yeah, I mean, I think the premature babies thing really surprised me, that so many premature babies are on Medicaid, really almost all of them. And the other thing I'd say is that you can actually be pretty far well off and still use Medicaid if you have a disabled kid. And that's because of some special legislation that went through that Mary Beth can talk about a little bit more. But this special rule that allows families to keep their children at home and not be in a hospital and be cared for at home, even if they have resources, because it's critical care. And we've all decided this is critical care. The other thing is it's much less expensive to provide care in the home. And that's really critical as well.
And Mary Beth, what percentage of people on Medicaid are children?
So nationally, Medicaid covers 44% of all kids with special health care needs. And so I think that's an important point, and we can talk about that in a bit. But nationally, overall, in terms of enrollment, children are 43%, and that includes healthy children as well as some children with special needs.
And listeners, we can take your phone calls for Mary Harris, our health reporter, and Mary Beth Musumeci, Associate Director of the Kaiser Family Foundation for Medicaid and the Uninsured, with your questions about Medicaid. Also, your stories of being on Medicaid. Are you on a Medicaid plan? What's your healthcare story that you think other people might be interested in hearing about, maybe as something that's instructive about what Medicaid actually is? 212-433-2000. WNYC, 212-433-9692. Here, I want to play a clip of presidential advisor Kellyanne Conway describing to George Stephanopoulos on ABC what she thinks will happen if the repeal and replace care repeal and replace bill that's making it through Congress goes through, and a lot of people are in effect kicked off Medicaid.
You know, Obamacare took Medicaid, which was designed to help the poor, the needy, the elderly, the sick, the disabled, also children and pregnant women. It took it and it went way above the poverty line and opened it up to many able-bodied Americans who should probably should at least see if there are other options for them. If they're able-bodied and they want to work, then they'll have employer-sponsored benefits like you and I do.
So that's a very direct argument, Mary Beth, that there are people who don't deserve the government benefit because if they're able-bodied, they should at least see if there are other options for them. If they're able-bodied and want to work, then they'll have employer-sponsored benefits like you and I do, said Kellyanne Conway. What's your response to her?
A couple of things. I want to first respond to the Medicaid expansion point and then talk about the broader Medicaid financing. So the Affordable Care Act did expand Medicaid to adults up to 138% of the federal poverty level. That's about $16,000 a year in 2017 for an individual. And I think there's a misconception.
So that's the new level. That's the higher level, is $16,000 a year for an individual with no dependents. If they're below that income, they would now be eligible for Medicaid under Obamacare.
That's right. And that is provided that the state chooses to implement that option.
Mm-hmm.
So we have about 32 states that are doing that right now. I think it's a misconception.
That was 1/6, by the way, right? That was not $60,000 a year. That was just $16,000 a year. Just clarifying.
Yes, that's correct. So I think it's a misconception to refer to that group as entirely able-bodied. My colleagues at the Kaiser Family Foundation have done some analysis of the data. And first, we find that 6 in 10 are working or in working families. So people at that income level who can work are working. It's just that they don't often have access to jobs that provide employer-sponsored coverage. They're in the service industry. They're in seasonal employment, jobs that don't offer health insurance. Among those who reported that they weren't working, over a third reported being too ill or disabled to work, and then about 3 in 10 reported that they were caring for a child or otherwise taking care of the home. And then I think it was about 1 in 5 were reported that they were in school. So folks who aren't working are doing something else, fulfilling other responsibilities. The other point I wanted to make on this is some of the adults in the expansion are childless adults with disabilities. They are less likely to be working, and even if they are working, they are also less likely to be in a job that offers health insurance.
And I just want to jump in here because I feel like we need to talk about this idea of the able-bodied Medicaid recipient, because no matter what happens with the Better Care Reconciliation Act, we're going to hear that come up a lot more over the next year. And the reason why is that the states are applying to Medicaid right now for these waivers that will let them cut people off of Medicaid for different reasons, for a positive drug test, for the fact that they're able-bodied. And so is this okay? I think we need to be having a conversation about whether this is okay and how this aligns with our values, because even if what's happening in Washington doesn't happen, we're still going to be having these waivers happen all over the country, and they're going to really impact who gets care and who has access.
So under the Republican bill, Mary, let's say you're making $18,000 a year and you have no dependents, and they end the Obamacare subsidies for buying insurance in the private sector. They would only give you tax credits, but you don't pay a lot of taxes on $18,000 a year. How would that person be expected to afford health insurance?
Well, that's exactly the issue, is that it can be unaffordable. States today and under the bill would still, in theory, have the option to expand coverage, and some states do expand Medicaid coverage to people at relatively higher incomes. However, this gets back to the second point I wanted to make, which is that the bill that the House passed and the bill that the Senate is currently considering goes beyond just repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act. And the way that it does that is it fundamentally changes the way the Medicaid program is structured in terms of federal financing. Right now, there's a guarantee to states. As state money increases, whether that's in response to a public health emergency like the Flint water crisis in Michigan or Zika or the opioid crisis, federal spending increases to meet it. And the bills would change that to cap federal funding and limit federal funding so that states would have less money. And so states would be put in the difficult situation of either having to find money from somewhere else in their budgets, potentially raise taxes, or else scale back some of these optional services and eligibility pathways. Some of them optional pathways are important to people who need long-term care, like seniors and people with disabilities, people who have long-term needs that aren't adequately covered by private insurance or aren't affordable.
Let's take some phone calls. People are calling in with their stories of being on or using Medicaid services. Let's start with Sarah in Burlington, New Jersey. Sarah, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, thanks. I'm really glad you guys did this today. My girls are on New Jersey Family Care. My husband and I have marketplace plans, but our income is right on that cut. And he works very, very hard. But a lot of people think that, like, we don't tell them they're on this Medicaid plan because they would think that, you know, that we don't contribute or that we don't work. But really, we do.
Hmm. And that's another way that you may not know how you're touched by Medicaid, which is in New Jersey. It's called New Jersey Family Care. It's not called Medicaid.
Yeah.
So that's interesting, too.
And so,
yeah, a lot of people don't realize that it's Medicaid. A lot of people, luckily for us, when we have to tell them, but it's definitely Medicaid. We're very, very fortunate and very, very lucky to have it.
Why is the situation that, if I understood you correctly, you and your husband are on private sector insurance, but your child is on public insurance?
Our income is right on the cusp, so we qualify for a marketplace plan, but the New Jersey Family Care is tiered. Your income can be a certain amount. So you pay a premium or you have copays, and then it goes up from there.
Sarah, thank you so much. Good luck to you and your family.
You're welcome. Thanks so much.
Emily in Rye, you're on WNYC. Hi, Emily.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
And you also have a story about your child, huh?
I do. I wanted to share my experience as the parent of a special needs child who's 8 years old, turning 9 in September. My husband and I have 5 children. When my son was born, he was developmentally normal, and we always wanted a large family, and we went on to have, when I had my 4th child, my oldest son, who has special needs, Mark, was totally fine. And then he began to decline. We were told that he would be fine by the time he was 8, and he got much worse, but not before we went on to have a 5th child. So last summer, it became so difficult to care for him, and I experienced so much shame at not being able to care for him ourselves. We're not indigent, but we were spending almost all of our resources and all of our savings trying to keep him safe. He has no language. He would run in the street. He'll jump on top of cars. He has behaviors. He needs 24/7 supervision. So it was a long process for me to even apply for Medicaid, but I did. And when we got it, I have to say that the respite service that we received, those 20 hours a week, have changed our life. And they made it possible for, at one point I was thinking, we were thinking of institutionalizing him. And it's hard for me to even say those words without mm-hmm. feeling some shame and humiliation. But I've only had the respite service since April. And the way we were granted it is it was going to be 20 hours for 8 weeks. And so every week, I never know if it's going to go away. And I just wanted to share with your listeners that there are people of all levels of income, you know, who are hardworking, who are good parents and good people, who are depending on this service.
Emily, thank you so much for your call, and good luck to you and your family. Wow, Mary.
You know, what's so interesting about both of those callers is they talk about the shame that's associated with illness and that's associated with getting these benefits. And I think that's really important to pay attention to here, because when you feel that shame, it's much easier for people to take the benefits away because you feel guilty about them. And so we need to just think about that. Like, what's going through our heads that may make it more possible for these cuts to happen, and how could we do it a little bit differently?
So to bring it back to politics for a minute, Mary Beth, I'm guessing that the Republicans, upon hearing that last caller's story, for example, would say, we are not targeting your child with those disabilities to be taken off a Medicaid insurance program. So as heartrending as your story is, don't confuse that with what we're trying to do to reform the Affordable Care Act.
Right. And so in response to stories like that, the Senate bill has a provision that says that it will take children with disabilities out of what's called the per capita cap, the federal financing funding limit and reduction. But the way the program is structured, it only reaches some of those children. It's only reaching children who are eligible based on a disability. And most children, including those with special health care needs and disabilities, will come into the program based on their family's low income or another reason, like their foster care status. In addition, it's a very high, very stringent test to meet Social Security's definition of disability. And there are many children who have special health care needs, who use services to a greater extent than typical children, who don't meet that test but nevertheless have significant needs. And so I think at the end of the day, the Congressional Budget Office has estimated substantial funding reductions of great magnitude, about over $700 billion over 10 years. So by 2026, there will be a 26% reduction nationally in the amount of federal Medicaid money that's going to states. And I think with reductions of that magnitude, there's no one who's going to be immune from the cuts and the very difficult decisions that states are going to have to make to come up with savings from their programs in order to live in that new environment.
You're saying cuts and you're saying reductions, but I want to play another clip of Kellyanne Conway on ABC with George Stephanopoulos, because the Republican pushback is constantly that these are not cuts, these are just cuts in the rate of growth of Medicare, which is currently unsustainable. So this clip starts with George Stephanopoulos' question.
You said everybody who's on Medicaid now is grandfathered in and is not going to face any cuts. And that simply is not factual if you have more than $800 billion in cuts. It also
raises... keep calling them cuts, but we don't see them as cuts. It's slowing the rate of growth in the future and getting Medicaid back to where it was.
So, Mary Harris, have you fact-checked this?
Well, so here's the thing, which is these cuts are actually pointing to something really important, which is that healthcare spending is very, very high. And so we need the rate of spending to go up to meet the need that's there. So it is a cut. It's a cut to future spending. And I believe it's a cut. But yes, you could look at the graph and show that the spending is continuing to go up. But will it meet the need that's there? And I think it's really important to acknowledge this, because this conservative idea of we're spending too much is completely legitimate. But the problem is that Mary Beth actually pointed this out to me, that this budget reconciliation they're doing in Washington is a very blunt instrument. It's just cutting dollars, right? But we're not going into Medicaid and changing what Medicaid's all about. And Medicaid has some things that are mandated that the states cover and some things that are optional. Some of the things that are optional include prescription drugs, include in-home care, include things that we've come to think of as vital services that also actually might save us some money in the long run. But the states wouldn't have the discretion to keep those going, because it's required that they cover things like hospital stays, nursing care, institutionalization, stuff that we put into this law in 1965 when we originally came up with it. We have really different values as a society right now. And so if we can go back into Medicaid and rethink it, okay, but that's not what we're doing.
We also hear from opponents of government insurance for the poor that Medicaid is not effective in terms of health outcomes. For example, in 2008, Oregon had a lottery system for its expansion of Medicaid, and then a study looked at the winners and losers of the lottery to compare healthcare outcomes. They found that lottery winners who got to enroll in Medicaid had no better healthcare outcomes than the lottery losers who were uninsured. Mary, are you familiar with the Oregon study?
Yeah, I really want to take on this question because we also have to keep in mind it's not a that's not a long-term study by its nature, because they were looking at something relatively quick turnaround. You're not looking at 20 years of data, right? And that's important. And it's important because what we're looking at now is very similar to what we did with welfare to work and welfare reform, where we're putting in place block grants. And we also used very similar data showing if we put people back to work and instead of keeping them on welfare, they'll be better off. But when they looked at the long-term data for welfare, they found, oh my gosh, the people who were educated did better off in the long run. And I think health is very, very similar. There was actually another article in the New England Journal a few weeks back by Atul Gawande, who you may or may not know from The New Yorker. And it had one of the same authors from that Medicaid study in Oregon. And it looked at longer-term data, and it showed that coverage definitely does save money. So I think that you know, that study is important. It's good, but we need to be looking long term, because your health is a marathon. It's not the end point is a long way down the line.
Pamela in Northport, you're on WNYC. Hi, Pamela.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. One of the things that I think perennially comes up for me when I hear these arguments. Is my own situation some years back, where even though I had worked two jobs at the same time at one point, my husband was in school because we had started a family and realized that we really needed to get more education and go forward. Neither job that I had provided any sort of healthcare benefit. So I went, luckily, I lived in Seattle at the time, and they had a very, very good Medicaid program, and I was able to get on that. The fascinating thing was that I was also treated very poorly because of that. When I went to have my first child, I was going to an OBGYN at a hospital, and they opened their notebook, and I looked in there, and I found there is a giant sticky note, bright yellow, that said on the family welfare program to let anybody opening that know that, that perhaps they would not get the money that they were hoping for from me.
How do you think that affected the care that you got?
Oh, it definitely impacted it. The person who I was dealing with, the doctor, really took very little interest in my case. I was basically shunted off. There was just a complete lack of care for care, if that's the mm-hmm. way you can put that. What stopped it, interestingly, was another doctor came in and was substituting for my own, and she opened the file and saw that and ripped the big yellow sticky off and absolutely caused a huge to-do. She could not believe that that's what they had done, and she ended up taking up my case, and it ended up being much, much better once she made a point of making a big deal about that.
Right. And Pamela, I'm going to leave it there for time, but thank you very much for sharing your story. It's really both one of the upsides and one of the downsides of Medicaid. One, it helped you afford your care. On the other hand, you were treated as a second-class citizen. It's interesting to me that the calls that we're getting are coming from all over the metropolitan region with people's stories of being on Medicaid.
Yeah.
If we think, if people are tempted to stereotype it as something for,
One
kind of person who lives in the urban center. This caller was from Northport, Long Island. The previous caller was from Rye and Westchester.
Yeah.
Let's take one more call. Lexi in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Lexi, you're a nurse, right?
Yes.
Hi.
And I just want to... I'll be brief, but basically being a nurse in the emergency room, I wanted to address what one of your speakers talked about in looking, I'm all for expanding Medicaid, but I think I witness a lot of abuses within it. Like, for instance, people come in and if they don't necessarily, the health problem doesn't necessarily like require an ambulance home, but they're like, well, I have Medicaid. And so that's kind of, sometimes I see that a lot.
Do you think we could cut down on abuses like that without kicking people off their benefits?
Absolutely. That's why I think what your speaker was talking about, looking more into the program to reform the program itself, and not just cutting. I don't think anybody that needs it should be cut.
Lexi, thank you so much. Mary Beth from Kaiser, do you want to address that?
Yes, and I think that's a really important point, that the way that this legislation is set up is looking just at reducing federal spending and not looking at how the program could be improved. We talk to all 50 states annually, and we know that many of them are very focused on delivery system reforms, thinking about how to deliver better care and improve health outcomes. And some of those things could achieve program savings in the long term from greater efficiencies, but many of them also require upfront investment. And so that's another reason why states are reliant on having that federal money there to help them improve their programs.
Mary Harris, you want to wrap this up by reminding people what your project here at WNYC is with respect to Medicaid?
Yeah, if you go to WNYC.org, you can see our graphic. You can share them on Twitter or on Facebook, and they really reveal how we are all touched by this program and how we all need to pay attention to what's happening with it in Washington, because if you're not affected by it now, you may be affected by it later. You probably know someone who's affected by it, so it's really vital.
WNYC's Mary Harris and Kaiser Family Foundation Associate Director for Medicaid and the Uninsured, Mary Beth Musumeci. Thanks both for coming on today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.